Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are jumping into a topic that is, I think it's fair to say, both constantly evolving and often, well, deeply misunderstood.
That's putting it mildly.
We're taking on feminism, and our guide for this is Margaret Walter's really essential book, Feminism. A very short introduction.
It's a perfect starting point because it cuts right through all the noise.
Exactly. It gives us that historical clarity.
And if we're going with Walters, I think our first job here is to just, you know, dismantle a huge misconception.
Which
is caricature of feminism as some kind of single monolithic anti-male crusade.
Right.
Walters basically spends the whole book showing us step by step why that image is just completely wrong.
So the central idea we're getting to today is that feminism isn't one thing. It's this complex, dynamic, sometimes even contradictory tapestry of different movements.
All held together by just one core belief.
The social, economic, and political equality of the sexes.
That's it. So this deep dive is really about understanding where that idea came from and how incredibly diverse it has become across the globe.
Okay, let's unpack our guide a bit. Who is Margaret Walters? Why should we trust her on this journey?
She's a really distinguished British writer and academic, but her background is in literature and art, which is key.
So she's not just a political historian.
No, not at all. And that's what makes her perspective so powerful. She's a cultural analyst.
You can see that in her her earlier work, right? The book on the male nude.
The Nude Male from 1978, a groundbreaking book. She basically reversed the traditional male gaze that had dominated art history for centuries.
So she's always been interested in how ideas are constructed.
Precisely. She looks at gender itself as a construction, something we build through our culture, through paintings, through novels, through pop culture. It means she can weave together political history with these cultural insights in a way that's just so accessible and, you know, authoritative.
So the book itself, it's short, but it's got huge scope.
It's designed to get you beyond the stereotypes. Fast. It gives you the core ideas and the key milestones.
And it traces this long chronological journey.
A really long one. It actually starts way earlier than most people think with what she calls proto-feminists.
Like Christine de Pizan back in the 15th century.
Yeah, challenging medieval misogyny in writing. But the real intellectual starting block is the Enlightenment.
And from there we get into the waves, as they're called. First wave is about legal rights.
Suffrage, property, the basics of citizenship.
Then the second wave, which is a much deeper cultural critique. It's about sexuality, family, power.
The personal is political idea. Massive expansion of what feminism was even about.
And crucially, Walters makes it clear this isn't just a Western story.
No. The final part of the book really expands the view globally, looking at how feminism operates differently when it confronts things like post-colonialism, or religious fundamentalism, it has to adapt.
Okay, so let's dig in. The intellectual cornerstone, the 18th century.
We have to start with Mary Wollstonecraft. Her book from 1792, A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, just lays the entire foundation for what's to come.
And what Walters points out so brilliantly is how Wollstonecraft did it.
Her genius was in taking the Enlightenment's own core value.
Reason. The idea that reason is universal to all humans.
Exactly. She took that logic and just turned it against the patriarchy.
She basically said, okay, if reason is our defining quality, why are you denying half of humanity the education needed to cultivate it?
Precisely. It wasn't just unfair to women. She argued it was damaging to all of society. You can't have rational citizens, good mothers, or even good partners if they're kept in a state of ignorance.
So the goal was about rational participation in society.
It was about becoming full citizens.
So we fast forward to the 19th century, the first wave. This is where those ideas turn into actual, organized political action.
And it didn't come from nowhere. Walters shows how early activists, women like the Grimke sisters, learned their skills, public speaking, organizing in the abolitionist movement.
Fighting to end slavery.
Right. And that experience directly led to the landmark event in the U.S., the Seneca Falls Convention in 1848.
The Declaration of Sentiments.
And the central fight of this entire wave, for decades, was suffrage, the right to vote, because they saw the vote as the key.
The tool you needed to unlock everything else, like property rights or divorce rights.
Exactly. But what's fascinating is the tension in their strategies.
You had the moderates like Millicent Fawcett in Britain, who were all about lobbying and constitutional methods.
And then you had the militants, Emmeline Pankhurst and the suffragettes.
They were not just lobbying.
Oh, no. They were smashing windows, going on hunger strikes, getting arrested. It was direct action to force the issue into the headlines.
That political drama then gives way to something else entirely in the 1960s and 70s, the second wave.
Which was like a conceptual earthquake.
Yeah.
And the intellectual architect here is really Simone de Beauvoir.
The Second Sex, 1949.
That book just changed the entire conversation.
Because of that one famous line, one is not born, but rather becomes a woman.
Yes. The implication of that is just massive. It's the philosophical split between biological sex and socially constructed gender.
It shifts the focus away from just laws.
And onto identity itself. De Beauvoir said society teaches you how to be a woman. It defines you in relation to men as the secondary dependent other.
And if it's something you learn,
then it can be unlearned. It can be dismantled.
That idea then lights a fire in America with Betty Friedan.
Right. In The Feminine Mystique, she identified the problem that has no name.
Such a powerful phrase.
It perfectly captured this deep, quiet unhappiness of suburban housewives in the post-war era. They had the nice house, the kids, the consumer comforts, but felt this profound emptiness.
Friedan's point was that this wasn't a personal problem, like a neurosis.
No, it was a political problem, a societal cage.
Which brings us right to that core slogan of the whole second wave. The personal is political.
This was the real break from the first wave.
What does it actually mean?
It means that the things we used to think of as private matters, housework, sex, domestic violence, body image, are in fact deeply political.
They're rooted in power imbalances.
Systemic ones.
Yeah.
And they require a collective political solution. That's where you get consciousness-raising groups, women's shelters, all of it. The home itself became a site of political struggle.
But the movement, it had its blind spots.
Big ones. It was very white, very middle class in its focus. And it faced these necessary critiques from within.
This is where black feminism and womanism come in.
Yes, and where we get the idea of intersectionality.
Yeah.
The term was coined later by Kimberly Crenshaw, but the concept was built by groups like the Combahee River Collective in the 70s.
And their argument was
that you can't just talk about sexism.
Yeah.
Because systems of oppression, racism, sexism, classism, they're not separate lanes.
They're all tangled together. They intersect.
And they reinforce each other.
Yeah.
So a working class black woman's experience of the world isn't just sexism plus racism. It's something different, a unique multiplication of those forces.
And that insight forced feminism to get a lot more complex, a lot more honest.
And a lot more global. That complexity is what leads Walters into the third wave and beyond. The movement has to look beyond its Western roots.
Because the challenges are different everywhere else.
Completely. How do you talk about feminism in a post-colonial context? Or when facing religious fundamentalism? The priorities might be land rights or access to clean water, not necessarily the same issues that dominated in the West.
So zooming out a little, what are the big themes we should take from Walter's work?
I think the first one is just that feminism is an evolution, not a monolith. Its real strength isn't that everyone agrees. It's that it's constantly questioning itself, adapting and responding to internal critique.
Okay, that's a big one. What's next?
The second is the profound interconnection of public and private life. The idea that our personal experiences in our relationships, in our families, aren't just personal. They are reflections of a wider political system.
You can see that so clearly today, can't you? With things like emotional labor?
Absolutely. Who in a relationship is expected to remember the birthdays, schedule the appointments, manage the social calendar?
Right.
Seeing that as a product of gendered social conditioning, not just how we are,
yeah.
That's applying the personal is political right now.
The third theme has to be intersectionality.
The indispensability of it. Walter shows the movement is just, well, incomplete and ineffective if it ignores how race, class, and sexuality change the experience of gender. The most important insights always come from the margins.
And the last one feels like a warning.
Yeah. The pervasiveness of backlash, every single step forward has been met with fierce resistance. It's a reminder that no gains are ever permanently secure. They always require vigilance.
Let's touch on some of those core statements, the ideas that really stick with you.
Okay, let's start with the big one from De Beauvoir.
One is not born, but rather becomes a woman.
I mean, that just blows the doors off traditional gender roles. It separates your biology from your social destiny. If gender is something we learn, something we perform, then we can change the script.
Then the revolutionary slogan, the personal is political.
It was revolutionary because it just massively expanded the battlefield.
Yeah.
The struggle wasn't just in parliaments anymore. It was in kitchens, in bedrooms. It made private suffering a public issue.
And finally, let's go back to the very beginning, to Wollstonecraft.
If reason is the defining human quality, then denying women an education is to deny them their very humanity.
It's so powerful because she's using their own logic against them.
She's not asking for a favor. She's making a logical demand based on the core values of her time. It's the unshakable intellectual foundation for everything.
So bringing this all together, how does knowing this history actually help you, the listener, navigate the world today?
Well, on a personal level, it gives you the tools, the language, to recognize and question gendered expectations in your own life.
Why are certain chores or emotional tasks still so often gendered?
Exactly. It helps you see those subtle imbalances for what they are. Social constructions, not natural facts.
And what about in the workplace?
It equips you to see systemic bias, the pay gap, the glass ceiling. You understand these aren't just about a few bad managers. They're about structures. And it empowers you to argue for changes like paid parental leave, not as a favor, but as a requirement for a just system.
And finally, it makes you a much smarter consumer of media.
Oh, absolutely. Mm. You can see right through the post-feminist narratives.
The idea that equality has been achieved, so why are you still complaining?
Right. Walter's history shows you that's just the latest version of the backlash. You understand that today's fights over hashtag Me Too, reproductive rights, they're just the next chapter in a very, very long story.
For me, what was most surprising was seeing how crucial the internal critiques were. The concept of intersectionality didn't weaken the movement. It forced it to self-correct and made it stronger, more honest.
That's a great point. It shows that listening to the margins is what keeps it alive.
So what's the final thought we should leave with?
I think the most provocative idea Walters gives us is this.
By showing us the history, she proves that the inequalities we see all around us are not natural. They aren't inevitable.
They're built by specific historical and cultural forces.
Exactly. And if they were built, they can be challenged. They can be dismantled and reconstructed. And that shows that feminism remains this incredibly vital, evolving framework for trying to build a more just world for absolutely everyone.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.